This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Well, in this hour, we look at a harsh and, until recently, secret report out of Pakistan that sheds new light on the killing of Osama bin Laden and the 9 years he was able to live in Pakistan undetected. We talk to one Republican congressman about whether his party feels any pressure as the House takes up immigration reform. And you had a lot of words in reaction to our discussion yesterday about swearing. One theater expert says if you want to know the true value of foul language, just turn to Shakespeare. That's all this hour. But first, Egypt. As American officials continue to hedge over whether what's taken place in Cairo is truly a coup, with some $1.5 billion in aid on the line, two of the richest Arab nations have already outspent the United States, pledging $8 billion to Egypt. Saudi Arabia and Qatar offered the large financial aid package in a move to stabilize the uncertain interim government there in Egypt, and it sends a strong signal of influence in the region. Meanwhile, the U.S. stands by, still issuing no declarative stance on its aid to Egypt.
Our aid to Egypt is an opportunity to mold the future. And in my mind, that future has to be an Egypt for all, one in which all the different elements of Egyptian society participate in their government.
That is Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey and chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who, unlike the White House, says we should be using U.S. foreign aid to influence the process in Egypt. We're going to hear more from Menendez tomorrow on the program. But that issue there of inclusion, well, that seems to be also in question today, as Egypt's state prosecutor issued warrants for Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohammed Badi and a number of other senior officials. It's a move that stands in stark contrast to Ashraf Ekoli, Egyptian ambassador to the United States, who described the process of forming an assembly to create a new constitution in Egypt on Sky News. Listen.
It started by a small committee. They will revise the frozen constitution. Later on, it will be a bigger committee of 50 members. It will include all representatives from the Egyptian society, even youth, women.
Throughout all of this, the U.S.'s hands appear to have been tied, not wanting to call a coup, not wanting to come out for or against the Muslim Brotherhood. Earlier today, I spoke with P.J. Crowley, former State Department spokesman and current professor at George Washington University, about the U.S. government's next moves as it anxiously watches Egypt over these next few days and weeks.
The United States will continue to support Egypt. It's a vitally important country. How Egypt goes will say a lot about how the Middle East goes going forward. And as you mentioned, other regional powers are already stepping up with aid. So the United States is in this kind of conundrum in order to continue, if not expand, not just military support, but civilian support to Egypt. It has to find another word to describe what's happening besides coup. The interim government is a step forward, but it also reveals the deep political divide that still exists across the Egyptian political spectrum, but also within the opposition. You had the kind of false start earlier this week where El-Baradei was rumored to be the incoming interim prime minister, only to have one of the opposition factions, the Nur party, object. Right. Now El-Baradei's the vice president. This will be reassuring to the international community, but the dilemma is El-Baradei, as one example, has very little political constituency within Egypt.
Does the speed with which the Egyptian authorities, the interim government, moved to this plan that we just heard about, the interim council, constitutional redraft and elections, really, really fast? Take us behind the scenes if you can a little bit, because you have so much experience in the diplomatic world. If the United States' hands are tied publicly, isn't it likely that we were moving behind the scenes to get this announcement as fast as possible?
Well, I don't think the United States' hands are tied per se, but just to recognize what happens in Egypt will be based on decisions made by Egyptians, good decisions as well as bad decisions. You know, certainly the United States' message to Egypt, both publicly and privately, is okay. You want a democratic reset, get back to a civilian, democratically elected government as soon as possible and make it inclusive, which is the primary dilemma, you know, for the military and the interim government, finding a way to re-engage the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a significant element within, you know, the Egyptian political realm, convincing them to let go of President Morsi, re-engage, re-compete, and become part of a more inclusive government than the one that Morsi was leading over the past year.
I wonder what problems it presents for our interests in Egypt, as we hear now and we've heard on the show, that both sides in the protests and in the fights, each of them blames the other for of being clients and puppets of the United States. The Muslim Brotherhood blames the protesters and the secularists of that. The secularists turn right around and say that Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood were actually in bed with the United States. And in all of these arguments, the boogeyman is the United States.
Sure. And we have the only unifying factor in all of what you just said is the fact that everyone's angry at the United States for something. I think that comes with the territory. Ultimately, if Egypt turns out right, the United States will have a positive and constructive relationship with a new Egypt.
PJ Crowley, former State Department spokesman, currently professor at George Washington University. Thanks, PJ.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's turn to domestic policy now, where last month, as you'll remember, the Senate passed a sweeping bipartisan overhaul of the nation's immigration system. But Speaker John Boehner says the House will not take up that bill, instead opting to draft its own version of immigration reform. Well, Senator John McCain has called upon Republicans in the House to act quickly and find a way to work with the Senate. Listen.
A failure to act is de facto amnesty for 11 million people living in the shadows. I think wherever you are on that issue, there's agreement on that. So then shouldn't we sit down together and solve this this issue?
In addition to that, John McCain and others have said a failure to act spells doom for Republicans in 2016 because they will not have any value to Latino voters. He's not the only Republican who warns about that. That was John McCain on Face the Nation. Well, today, House Republicans meet in a closed-door session to begin to iron out their own vast differences on immigration reform. One congressman who will be in on that meeting, Republican Blake Fahrenthold, representing Texas' 27th District. Hi, Congressman.
Hey, good to be with you.
And good to have you. What do you expect from this meeting today? We expect it to last hours and be contentious. There isn't any consensus among Republican ranks about what to do, and it's certainly not the Senate bill.
Well, I tell you, these conference meetings typically only last a little over an hour, so I would be surprised if it's a marathon session. I think the leadership wants to take the pulse of the rank-and-file membership and see what our points of agreement are and start from there.
Points of agreement might be like increased border security, increased high-tech visas. Am I on the right track?
It is. You can take a look at what's already been passed out of the House Judiciary Committee as probably a map.
Right. Well, Blake Fahrenthold, in the Texas 27th, you're, however, a bit of a standout from a lot of your Republican colleagues. You come from a district with a heavy Hispanic population, and you have also favored what you call earned legalization. That's another way of saying it might be different from what the Senate passed, but the Senate has this 13-year pathway to legalization or pathway to normalization or citizenship, whatever you want to call it. There are not a lot of members of your Republican conference there that are going to agree with you on that, and that's part of the problem of reaching an agreement here, right?
Well, there's a difference between legalization and citizenship. You know, it could be permanent resident status. One of the cornerstones of my philosophy on immigration is you've got to create a system that doesn't reward illegal behavior, doesn't put us back in the same boat we are now, you know, 20 years down the road, and is compassionate and has border security.
Well, what are the conversations like with your Republican colleagues? Because a lot of the political people scratch their heads and say, yeah, 2014, okay, a midterm election when everybody just goes back to their districts. Republicans who refuse to support immigration reform, they can do just fine. But 2016, if this party doesn't get on board with something that 60, 70% of the public wants, not to mention Latino voters, we don't have a chance. What are your conversations like when Republicans hear that from John McCain and Lindsey Graham and other people?
Well, the big conversation that I'm having with my colleagues is we've got to speak about this better. We're portrayed as haters on the issue. And Hispanics, especially Texas Hispanics, are conservative by nature. They're traditionally Catholic or a more Christian. So they've got us on we've got them on family values. We've got them on abortion. And most of either if they're first generation or second generation immigrants, they or their parents came over looking for a job, looking for a way to make a better life for themselves, to live the American dream. I mean, those are fundamentally Republican values. But then any time a member of our party says something insensitive or stupid, it gets magnified and repeated and attributed to all of us. We've got to be very careful about how we speak because our political opponents are looking for opportunities to make us look like haters towards Hispanics, which we are not.
The conventional wisdom, Congressman Blake Farenthold, in Washington now is that the Senate, controlled by Democrats, won't pass immigration reform that doesn't have a pathway to legalization, is that the House will never pass immigration reform that does, and that starting today, immigration reform is dying a slow death. Do you want to buck that conventional wisdom?
I think you need to see what's going to happen. I think if the House is allowed to do their will, we will come up with something, and it may be not the thing that the Senate loves. It may not be the thing the House loves in the end when we get together. Remember, that's the way our founding fathers intended the system to work. Senate passes a bill, House passes a bill. We try to hammer it out. If we can get something both sides can agree to, and the president will sign, it becomes law. Let's let the process work out before we declare it dead.
Is there a fear that President Obama kind of has Republicans in a corner here? He has the Senate Democrats. He has comprehensive reform. And if he doesn't like what you guys pass, he says, hey, you get blamed for being haters. The public thinks you're haters. Fine with me. See you in 2016.
Listen, we are outmessaged consistently, and immigration isn't the only issue. We have got to up our game when it comes to talking about the issues that are important to us and where we stand. I'm a communications guy. I've been in radio since I'm 15. I'm going to do my part to help get the message out that we are not haters and we are the party of the American dream.
We appreciate you doing some of that part on this show. Congressman Blake Farenthold, Republican of the 27th District of Texas, and Radio Man. Congressman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, in a scathing report released, leaked to Al Jazeera this week, it's revealed that, quote, collective incompetence and negligence of Pakistan's military and intelligence allowed Osama bin Laden to remain on the run and hidden in that country for almost a decade. After the discovery and death of bin Laden 2 years ago in a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, the Pakistani government underwent an investigation into how the world's most notorious terrorist and wanted criminal evaded capture for so long, when it turns out he was hiding right under their noses the whole time. You'll remember that in Abbottabad, it's also the home of the Pakistani military academy. Well, that report, which the Pakistani government suppressed for 6 months, lays heavy blame on the military and intelligence, but also puts some of the blame on what it calls American arrogance. Joining me now to discuss the findings is Akbar Ahmed, chair of Islamic studies at the American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. He is author of The Thistle and the Drone. Hi, Akbar.
Hi, Todd. Nice to be back.
Welcome back to the show, as always. Well, this report is something you don't see every day. It's surprisingly frank. It spares all diplomatic language. It's scathing.
Todd, it is, especially in the context of Pakistan history. We've had huge events, historic events, like the separation of East Pakistan from Pakistan and becoming Bangladesh in 1971. And the report then, the Hamudur Rahman report, was not published for decades. We still don't know anything about Benazir Bhutto's murder officially. So the fact that the report is out, it is scathing. It particularly takes on the army establishment and the political establishment, talks of gross negligence, even hints at complicity, and then turns its guns on its main ally, Pakistan's main ally, the United States. As your introduction says, it talks of American arrogance knowing no bounds. This is a quote from the head of the intelligence. It talks of the raid which killed bin Laden as a criminal act, an act of war, and so on. So, you know, there is a very sharp edge to the report, which is unusual.
Well, we have to talk about what it reveals about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, and we'll get to that in a minute. But you touched on the issue of complicity. I mentioned before collusion, and I guess they're sort of two sides of the same coin. The report hints at it, but doesn't really go there. And a lot of people in the United States all along have said bin Laden could not have hidden there for 9 years without somebody within the Pakistani military or ISI, the intelligence service, knowing about it and helping him.
Well, this was one of the first things I said in public in the media straight after the killing of bin Laden, because I was assistant commissioner in Ahmedabad, so I know the area. I grew up there. I was at school there in a Catholic school, Burnhall. And that area is really a cantonment. It's a military cantonment. The military academy, Pakistan's premier military academy, is a couple of hundred yards from that particular house. And the fact that an Arabic-speaking, very tall man living in this strange three-bedroom house, sealed off, and not being seen in public, would have caused a lot of comment. And Pakistanis are very curious about neighbors and so on. So I was extremely, extremely skeptical about no one knowing. The report confirms that at some level, it doesn't really point out at what level, but at some level there would have been some idea or knowledge of what was going on.
And you believe that that must be true?
This is what my gut instinct tells me, having been in that area and served in the civil service, the understanding that this could not have been possible without some element of complicity at some level. Now, at what level, history will alone let us know.
Or perhaps not, and we would have liked to have had more of that in a leaked report of this form. But you also mentioned some of the rhetoric in this report about stunning American arrogance. That's to be expected. After all, we flew helicopters into Pakistani airspace and violated their airspace. It also says act of war, strong words. We all know the relationship between Pakistan and the United States is troubled. Did we know it was this troubled?
Todd, as someone very committed to promoting good relationship between the United States and Pakistan and doing something about it, I have been very alarmed at the plunge, at the downward plunge of this particular relationship, because it is mutually beneficial and both need each other, not only for the present but for the coming time. And this report clearly tells us how troubled it is. Here we are hearing the top people in Pakistan, in the administration, the head of the intelligence services, really talking of America with the utmost contempt. In fact, talking of Raymond Davis, the person who was involved in that killing in Lahore, which the Americans said who was a diplomat, and Pakistanis in this report say he was a criminal, using the word criminal, and so on. So it shows the bitterness and the need to really put this relationship on a strong, even keel, which allows the relationship to move beyond this very bitter confrontation and trading of insults.
It might be a little bit troubling to have the trading of insults, at least the release of them, timed at the same time that we hear President Obama and the White House strongly considering a full United States troop withdrawal from Afghanistan as early as next year, because he's not getting along with Hamid Karzai either. And we may have a situation of no U.S. presence in Afghanistan and a horrible relationship with Pakistan.
Todd, you have picked up a very important point, and I hope the American media picks this up, because we really have to watch out for the coming time, because troop withdrawal is complicated enough. And when you have the host country, Afghanistan, so hostile, and Karzai actually said that I would side with the Taliban against the Americans, I mean, which is a stunning statement. And then you have a hostile Pakistan. Whatever happens, it does not benefit the United States. And therefore, I go back to my point, it is essential that the United States takes initiatives which restores a relationship with both countries, allowing it to play a role in the future, which it must, for all kinds of geopolitical reasons.
Well, the United States has been dealing with some leakers of its own recently, of course, and it appears that Pakistan has some leakers of its own, and we're learning a lot more, not only about the spiriting away of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad for 9 years, but also just maybe how bad the relationship between the United States and its sometimes ally, Pakistan, really is. Akbar Ahmed, Chair of Islamic Studies at American University and former ambassador from Pakistan to the UK. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to the show. Well, we started a discussion here on The Takeaway yesterday about swearing, about profanity, bad words, four-letter words. We've been hearing a lot from you on the topic and whether it's more prevalent today.
My name is John, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I was in the Navy for several years, and we didn't use profanity the way people always say sailors use profanity, but there were instances where it was used and it made a point.
Come on, John, I thought we're all supposed to swear like sailors. That's the point. But is swearing different in public?
My name is Leo, and I'm calling from San Mateo, California, and I think it is absolutely disgusting now that people find it so easy to swear. I ride the bus, and I find it very, very hard when people are just cussing and swearing. I think we need to have more respect for each other.
An alternative view from Leo there. Well, coming up in the show, we have a Shakespearean, Elizabethan view on swearing. It's not new, but you know that. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave us a comment on our website at thetakeaway.org. What if a city's concrete roadways doubled as an air freshener? Well, that's the dream of a group of Dutch scientists who have developed a product they describe as air purifying pavement. And the question now is, could the very streets you drive on eat smog? Well, Josh Brouwers, who is a professor at Eindhoven University of Technology, is part of a team working on this very thing. And he's joining us to describe a new technology he and his colleagues are testing that could clean the air using the streets. Hi, Professor.
Hello.
I've seen pictures in the newspaper of your smog-eating technology. It looks just like a regular street. How does it work?
Well, it's a concrete pavement, and this pavement is provided with a photocatalyst. And this photocatalyst, under the influence of UV light from the sun, degrades nitrogen oxides, which contribute to smog.
Nitrogen oxide, they call those NOx here, and there's also SOx, which is sulfur dioxide, right? Does it eat that too?
Yes, yes. We expect that SOx will also be degraded, but we did not measure that.
And it's made of titanium, you said. This sounds expensive.
Compared to concrete, it's expensive, perhaps 50% more expensive. But if you look at the integral cost, so also labor, the foundation work, which you always have involved with street modification, then the price increase is probably 10%.
Is it sturdy? You know, one of the things with concrete is they don't want to come back and have to repair it so quickly. Goodness knows they don't want to repair potholes very often. So does it last?
Yeah, it lasts. It's mixed in the top layer of the concrete, and technically it will last the same as a blank concrete.
Oh, it's the same durability. So take a city, you know, I'm in New York City, listeners in San Francisco or San Antonio, the big driving cities of America. Smog is less of a problem than it used to be, but still a big problem. What if they bought your concrete and they, let's say, you know, paved a quarter of San Francisco highways with it? How much of an effect would it have?
Well, that's difficult to assess because you have to look from situation to situation. In the setup where we measured, which was a narrow street, which was paved over the full width with this pavement and a length of 150 meters, and we compare that with another same street, but then 150 meters of blank concrete, there we saw a reduction of 20-25% when you look over the whole day, and 45% when you look in the afternoon.
On that street of the ambient smog.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the NOx degradation I'm talking about.
Josh Brouwers is professor at Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands, and he and his team have created concrete that eats smog. And so far in tests, it works, folks. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
When Lewis and Clark made their voyage across what would later become Montana, they saw a relatively untouched expanse of land. It was home to bison and deer, coyotes, and a lot of other native creatures. Well, what was there in the past is now the vision of a new organization called the American Prairie Reserve. With funding from high-profile, wealthy donors like billionaire Candy Ayers Forrest Mars Jr. and his brother John and Susan Packard Orr, who's daughter of the co-founder of Hewlett-Packard, the organization's been buying up properties all around Montana, trying to form the largest contiguous national park in the lower 48, an area of land about the size of Connecticut and surpassing Yellowstone by 1 million acres. And there, The American Prairie Reserve will reintroduce native species, including genetically purebred bison. Pete Geddes is one of the managing directors of the American Prairie Reserve, and despite some pushback from local ranchers and farmers who say the land doesn't need saving, Pete says preserving the grasslands would greatly add to our already robust collection of national parks.
I'm sure most of your listeners are quite familiar with the iconic Western national parks like Glacier, Yellowstone, Grand Teton, Yosemite. Those parks were formed relatively early in our nation's history and were often chosen for their geologic values. Yellowstone and Yosemite would be classic examples of that. What was missed in the formation of the parks are areas or ecosystems that also support a large amount of biodiversity. And the grasslands do just that. We know that about 200 years ago in the area of Montana where we're working, from the journals of trappers and Lewis and Clark, that there was an abundance and diversity of wildlife that was found nowhere else on the northern Great Plains. And furthermore, the grasslands are underrepresented globally from a conservation perspective. There are only four places left in the world, the northern Great Plains being one, where these grasslands still exist at a large enough scale and in an intact enough state, meaning they haven't been plowed up and converted to agriculture like most of the Great Plains has been.
So we mentioned wild bison, of course, deer and coyotes, a lot of other animals and flora as well, I'm sure. How close do you think you can get to the original flora and fauna of a place like that? I mean, man can't just recreate it. Nature has to do that. Can you get close to the way it was, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about with all conserved areas across the world, not rolling things back to the Pleistocene. That's not our goal, of course. But our goal is to preserve a semblance of what once was. All the native plants are still intact in our area, unlike other places that your listeners might be familiar with in the Great Plains, like Kansas or Iowa, for example, where the land has been turned and converted to agricultural commodity crops. The area where we're working has been grazed with cattle. So all the native plants are still there in their state. And of course, our goal is to assemble a landscape that's large enough so that when we put the wildlife back on there, like bison that was there 200 years ago, we have enough space where these animals don't get in trouble with neighbors.
Before we let you go, Pete Geddes, managing director of the American Prairie Reserve, my mind can't help but go back to frontier days and to Lewis and Clark, as we mentioned, as you talk about what you're doing there. And I wonder if you envision people who visit, you know, regular sort of modern day camping with high tech tents and GPS systems and solar grills, or do you think you're going to attract enthusiasts of antiquity, maybe let in some Conestoga wagons and maybe a way for people to get back to the way it was? I don't know.
That's a really interesting question. We have a group coming up from the Explorers Club, which is based in New York City, and they're actually going to recreate a section of Lewis and Clark's journey, and they're going to float down the Missouri River. They are interested, in some sense, in recreating that experience that Lewis and Clark had about 200 years ago. Other people, of course, are going to come into the reserve as they can do today and stay at campgrounds and drive their RVs around and experience it much like you would Yellowstone National Park. So there'll be a variety of ways people can experience the place, and our job is to make sure they do it in an appropriate way that protects the ecosystem and still allowing for them to enjoy this incredible nature experience.
Well, the American Prairie Reserve is looking to acquire a landmass about the size of Connecticut and raise $450 million to do it, to reintroduce native species to the land. This is all happening in the name of conservation and biodiversity, and not with your taxpayer money, but with rich folks' money. Pete Geddes is one of the people in charge. He's managing director of the American Prairie Reserve. Thanks, Pete.
Home, home on the range.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. The legality of waterboarding, the role of state-sponsored surveillance, the importance of whistleblowers. Just a few of the major questions tossed at James Comey before the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday. Comey, of course, President Obama's pick to head the FBI. From 2003 to 2005, Comey served as Deputy Attorney General under President Bush. And while he concurred with Justice Department memoranda that allowed for waterboarding at the time, he had different answers for Senator Patrick Leahy yesterday. Listen.
You agree that waterboarding is torture and is illegal?
Yes.
Thank you. And would you agree to answer this question the same way no matter who is president.
Oh, certainly.
Former FBI agent and division legal counsel Colleen Rowley thinks some of Comey's past positions deserve more scrutiny than they've gotten. She joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Hi, Colleen.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for being here. James Comey, of course, has been celebrated, gotten a lot of attention for being the guy in the Bush administration who turned up at the bedside of then Attorney General John Ashcroft to prevent Alberto Gonzalez and Andy Card, the White House chief of staff, from getting a sick, maybe partly delirious attorney general from signing off on a surveillance program that he thought he shouldn't have signed off on, and he was kind of the hero. But you think we need to go deeper on Comey?
Right. I think the media got that story. They projected him as speaking truth to power, and many of the senators yesterday echoed that line. But in fact, when you really look at what happened there, and again, the public does not really understand, Comey and Ashcroft and Goldsmith did not oppose the actual warrantless monitoring that was taking place under Bush. It looks like their dispute was the legal footing. And so when they changed the legal footing afterwards, Bush continued to illegally monitor, even though Ashcroft refused to sign. And so there were a period of days that was really kind of a crisis. And then the Department of Justice hit upon this novel way that they could go back to the authorization to use military force in October of 2001 and claim that there was an inherent power of the president to override congressional statute of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Of course, this hasn't been explained well. So people perceive Comey to be this courageous, almost a whistleblower, when in fact he went along with the illegal massive collection. Only thing is they changed the legal footing.
There's also the issue of waterboarding, where when he was working for the Bush Justice Department, Comey was well known, at least for, as I said, concurring with Justice Department memoranda that justified waterboarding at the time, now says he's against it and considers it illegal. Lots of people have had, well, what we'll call evolutions or transformations on this and other issues. Why is it troubling to you in Comey's case?
Well, it's troubling because in all probability, the next FBI director will be someone who has signed off on, actually, they call it in Latin, jus cogens. That means that the prohibition against torture is not only in the Convention Against Torture, it's not only a U.S. statute, the 1994 law that prohibits torture, but it's inviolable. It's so strong that there's no excuse or rationale. And so it's troubling because the senators lauded Comey's abiding by the law when, in fact, he violated. And I will give credit to some of the senators who read the gruesome depiction of sleep deprivation. We're shackled to the ceiling and shackled to the floor and forced to stand for up to 7.5 days. Al Franken read that description. I mean, these things are no-brainer that they're torture. And yet Comey went along with that. Now, he has some feeble excuses that the law, he claimed the law was vague, and he claimed that some of the senators kind of made an excuse for him that the CIA was misleading the Department of Justice, that torture worked. It was a very eye-opening segment, and many of the senators, you could see their concern. They asked Comey to read the 6,000-page report that the Senate Judiciary has come up with or has it's still classified, but they have voted on the 6,000 report that torture is ineffective.
There is also the issue of whistleblowers, Colleen Rowley. This country has had a lot of recent experiences with what you can call leakers or whistleblowers, I suppose, depending on your point of view. But this Obama administration is busy prosecuting certainly leakers under the Espionage Act. Some people call them whistleblowers. There are some people like Drake at the NSA, who a lot of people call a whistleblower, who was prosecuted. Listen to Comey's response in Judiciary about how he views whistleblowers.
I think whistleblowers are also a critical element of a functioning democracy. Folks have to feel free to raise their concerns, and if they're not addressed, up their chain of command to take them to an appropriate place.
Colleen Riley, you were a whistleblower. You helped expose some of the FBI's shortcomings pre-9/11 in a way that was eventually taken seriously. You take Comey seriously on the issue of whistleblowers?
Well, let me say, it is good that Comey is now recognizing, for instance, that waterboarding is torture and that torture is illegal. And he said over and over that it's important to learn from your mistakes. So that's good. What Comey did not explain, though, in that response back on whistleblowing is that the intelligence community, 16, 17 agencies, do not actually have any real whistleblower protection. And so when he says it's important to listen to whistleblowers, what happens inside agencies, and I can give you numerous examples, certainly the latest NSA is one, there's no outlet to when you spot a true illegal act, if your superiors are violating the Constitution, certainly fraud, waste, and abuse, and risk to public safety, there is no avenue, there is no channel. And so they're talking about having a channel in the chain of command, but it simply does not exist.
Well, at the same time, despite all these questions around James Comey, we can probably pretty much rely on the fact that he is going to be confirmed by the Senate to be next FBI director, at least if we take the reaction yesterday, mostly positive reaction, of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Colleen Riley, former FBI agent and division legal counsel and whistleblower at the FBI. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've been looking at the evolution of swearing over the past 75 years, from the days when damn first appeared on the big screen in Gone with the Wind to the present day, when far more offensive words are used routinely on TV shows that we watch every day and the content that we see online, of course. Well, dozens of you wrote in and called in to say that we overuse four-letter words these days and that doing so displays a lack of class at worst and overt laziness at best. Christina from Portland, Oregon wrote us to say, can't people be articulate enough to get their point across without being foul? I view people who pepper their daily conversations with swear words, especially the F word, as being truly classless. And we got this from Laura in North Dakota. Foul language reflects ignorance and a lack of respect for yourself and others. If you have a mastery of language, you can express yourself without the use of vulgarity. Well, Christina and Laura, I have to say, both of you might find conversation with me outside of a radio studio to be a little bit tedious. However, we're going to continue this discussion today with none other than the bard, William Shakespeare, because even some of the greatest poets and writers down through the classics, for them, swearing has long been a vital form of communications. And Anya Saffer, who's a theater director and instructor at the Atlantic Acting School and director of Shakespeare plays, is here to tell us how. Hi, Anya.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are here with the theory that William Shakespeare and a lot of his contemporaries were overt swear word users.
They were masters of profanity. Shakespeare had thousands of profanities, many of which he made up. It was kaleidoscopic. And I think that when people say that profanity is a sign of inarticulateness, Shakespeare would be an example of how that is not so.
Well, here's an example that I wanted to use because I have read these plays too. Here's an example from Othello, Act 1, Scene 1. Listen.
Even now, now, very now, an old black ram is topping your white ewe.
What? Profane wretch, art thou?
I am one, sire, that comes to tell you your daughter and the Moor are now making the beast with two backs.
Thou art a villain!
You are a senator!
There's the evil Iago goading another character. I'm going to dance around this, but essentially saying, there's a black guy having sex with your white daughter, and finding a pretty nasty way to say it.
What an image, the beast with two backs.
I'm going to say this. There are lots of examples that we're avoiding for the purposes of this discussion because they might be too dirty in Shakespeare for a radio show. What are some other examples you can think of?
Oh, my God. There are countless, countless examples. Well, to name some examples of words that mean the same thing as the beast with two backs, there is thump, occupy, cope, clap. We have innumerable words that refer to the female genitalia, including the word nothing, which makes you wonder about the title, Much Ado About Nothing, as well as box unseen, and my personal favorite, the Netherlands, as well as Spain. And there are, you know, as you can imagine, countless Spain and the Netherlands. There are countless words for the male organ. Many of them are very funny, such as simply the name Roger with a capital R.
All right, well, let me give you another example, if I can, that we are going to dance around after we listen to it. Maybe we'll just let this one lie. Listen to Hamlet.
Aye, lady, shall I sit in your lap?
No, my lord.
I mean my head on your lap.
Aye, my lord.
Thinking I meant country matters.
So there, as Hamlet is teasing Ophelia and talking about pastoral things, country matters, he's really sort of teasing her in a different way.
Well, there's clearly a word contained in the first word of that phrase, which had the same meaning then and the same risque quality that it does now. And Hamlet, throughout the play, is going back and forth between the sacred and the profane. He has the highest language, you know, perhaps that's ever been written, and some extremely low language, which I think really shows the fact that he's trying to find his way spiritually. He also says famously, get thee to a nunnery, to Ophelia. And at the beginning of that nunnery, that famous nunnery scene, he's criticizing men and himself particularly. He says, we are errant knaves all, believe none of us, go thy ways to a nunnery. And he's saying it sincerely, go to a nunnery, protect yourself from corruption. Later in the scene, there's a turning point where he starts to become more onto her and her corruption. And then he says again, over and over, get thee to a nunnery, get thee to a nunnery. And it seems to me that the word then takes on its slang usage, which is brothel.
Have your students had strong reactions when they've confronted for the first time that these concepts, these words, are actually contained in the pages of Shakespeare? I know it surprised me when I figured it out.
You know, I think honestly, my students by and large feel more trusting of Shakespeare, more enthusiastic about Shakespeare. I think that they know, even though some adults may try to close their ears to it, that life entails profaning and that profaning can be wonderful. It can be anti-establishment. A lot of artists are really attracted to that. And I think that they're grateful and excited to see that this part of life is being depicted with such imagination and color.
One of the things that Shakespeare did artistically and probably for business reasons was use elevated high concept and high language, but also knew that in front of the stage were the groundlings, the people who couldn't afford expensive tickets and might be into a different kind of humor. And he was working towards both of those crowds in his plays. And I think we do much of the same thing in our media today.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. There's a wonderful book called Shakespeare's Body. It is a 300-page glossary of Shakespearean profanities. And Eric Partridge writes in the introduction, he says, can we not finally be finished with this myth that the profanity in Shakespeare is there for the groundlings? Can we not be done with this classist notion? And I completely, completely agree. It's interesting because I think of somebody like Louis C.K., right, who is extremely profane. And the smartest and most sophisticated people that I personally know in the performing arts industry, actors, directors, writers, they love him. They revere him. People are really awed by him. He's working at an extremely high level. So I don't like to equate thinking like a simpleton with appreciating profanity. Profanity is like anything. It can be used with wisdom and wit and multiple meanings and give you insight into the world and your existence, or it can be cheap and empty.
So you reject the notion that came from a couple of our listeners at the top, not to single them out, but you reject the notion that using profanity or swearing is just a crutch for either a limited vocabulary or a limited intellect.
I know exactly what they mean. I feel it too sometimes even in myself or in the culture. I start to feel a little bit of self-loathing. Like, why am I using these words? It's so empty. It's so casual. I'm just throwing them around. However, I do not think that it is the fault of profanity. And I think that Shakespeare tells us that there's a way of using profanity that is just as imaginative and that can expand our worldview, that can expand our vocabulary, just like all language can.
Well, you have one foot in the world of Shakespeare and you have one foot in the modern world, clearly, Anya Saffer. How much do you swear in your daily life? Not at work, not when you're going through the script of Hamlet, but when you walk out here on the streets of Manhattan.
You know, I'm a native New Yorker. I do a certain amount of swearing. I love to express vehemence. I aspire to swear like my mother. She swears sometimes, always to excellent effect and for very specific reasons.
Razor sharp and to the point.
Yes.
Anya Saffer is a theater director and instructor at the Atlantic Acting School who aspires to swear just like her mother does. And you know what? I'm going to agree with that. That's how I aspire to, although I have to say, in fairness to my mom, I outdo her quite a bit. Thanks, Anya.
Thank you.
Well, you have had plenty to say about profanity.
This is David from Dayton, Ohio. Because you hear it so much on TV, I've explained to my son that there are rules. He can swear as soon as he is in an actual war as a soldier himself or aliens attack the Earth.
Rules for swearing. We always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.